Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, no matter where you're listening, around the world, this is Sedona Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us. This is Joanna Paxinu, and you're listening to At the Movies with Joanna. And today we're going to find out some wonderful news about the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. They do a lot more than offer the annual Academy Awards. They host many wonderful events and programs. And today we have a very special guest who will tell us about some of these events and one very special event. We are so thrilled to have with us Ellen Harrington, a programmer with the Academy. Welcome, Ellen. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me. I appreciate that.
We're so happy to have you here. First, if you could tell us a little bit about your position as programmer with the Academy.
Yeah, I'm actually the Academy's Director of Exhibitions and Special Events. And so what that means is throughout the year, even though obviously most people know about the Academy Awards and the fact that that happens every February, the Academy has a year-round slate of public programs, exhibitions, educational projects, and other things that happen not only in Los Angeles but in major cities throughout the world. And so I'm involved in actually creating a lot of that programming, curating a lot of the exhibitions, and then overseeing them as they go out and have their lives in different cities and different countries around the world.
Wow, that is exciting. Now, if people wanted to find out about these events, would it be on the website at the www.oscars.org?
Yes, Oscars.org is the best place to go. We do maintain two different websites, and Oscars.com is primarily devoted to the Oscar broadcast, and that is updated very specifically for the Academy Awards time and has a lot of post-Oscar information and video and other materials right after the show. And that's Oscars.com because that's sort of the business side of things, as it were, the giving out of the Academy Awards. Oscars.org is all of the Academy's activities. So we have the largest library of film materials anywhere in the world. We have a significant film archive. We have several theaters in Los Angeles and several exhibition spaces, a lot of educational programs, a lot of other competitions that people don't necessarily know about, like the Student Academy Awards. We have a screenwriting competition. We have a lot of grants and programs for film scholars, and many, many things that just anyone who's interested in film who would like to partake of a screening, attend a special clip show or tribute, a film series, an exhibition, all of those things are offered by the Academy to the public. And many of them are free of charge or very low cost. Most of the public programs that we do are only a $5 ticket.
Wow, that is wonderful. I was not aware that the Academy offered so much, so this is an education for me too. What about the shows that you say, the screenings or events that are sponsored in other cities? What type of show would that be, and what cities would they go to?
Well, the Academy has a large group of members in New York and in London, and we have regular public events for the public that are advertised for the public that take place in those cities, as well as events that take place only for the members. And in several other cities where we have either members or just a real interest in having a presence, we've partnered with some of the local institutions. So, for example, in San Francisco, several times a year we offer public film events, most often with either the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco or the San Rafael Film Center. And in Washington, D.C., this past year, we've been doing programs with the National Archives and with the National Geographic, which has a theater. We also make our programs available to film festivals that take place in other cities. And our exhibitions, we have gallery, museum-quality exhibitions on film history or the current production of film. And those exhibitions are available to travel, and usually about half a dozen of them are out at any one time around the world. And so they can be in Asia, in Europe, in other American museums or galleries. So most of that is available. Most of that kind of information is updated regularly at Oscars.org.
Wow, that is amazing. That is so wonderful. When you say there are museum-quality exhibits, what exactly would be included? That'd be stills from screen from films? Is that the...
It could be all kinds of things. I mean, we have an incredible archive of materials available to us through the Academy Library. We mm-hmm. also work with professional filmmakers, collectors, Academy members, people who have access to unique collections of material. And we try to do very different topics so that in any given year, pretty much anyone's going to see the listings that we have in our calendar and say, oh, that's an exhibition that I would like to go to the gallery and actually visit. So mm-hmm. right now we have two exhibitions that are closing this week that have been up since January. One is called Creating the Alfred Hitchcock Film, and it is a mm-hmm. multimedia exhibition that showcases the working process that Alfred Hitchcock brought to his creative process, mm-hmm. the team of people that worked with him. There's a big mythology that was created by the publicity machine that Alfred Hitchcock oversaw that made it seem as if he kind of created these movies, you know, entirely by himself and right. never even needed to come to the set and could direct from the back seat and all these legends we hear about him. And in fact, what we have is memos and publicity materials, letters, production design, drawings, photographs, a lot of footage, also audio tapes of production meetings that took place so that people can come and really understand how that was accomplished as opposed to the publicity mythology. At the same time, in another gallery in the building, we have a large photography show by a legendary Hollywood set photographer named Douglas Kirkland, who's published a book called Freeze Frame about his 5 decades of shooting everybody from Marilyn Monroe to Nicole Kidman and everybody in between. And we have 125 photos on display. We're about to change the exhibitions over, and in the summertime we'll have a contemporary movie set exhibition where 7 brand new movies, we will have set elements from each of those movies that people can actually interact with. We'll have Indiana Jones's office, a cave from Iron Man, the attic set from Spiderwick Chronicles, things of that nature
that
so that people
exciting.
Can come in and actually see how a set is decorated, learn about that craft, and actually interact with things from that set. At the same time, another exhibition that we'll have in the other gallery will be on hand-drawn animation from the 50s through the 90s, and we're highlighting work that was done by people who were on the film studio payrolls for decades as expert, you know, background artists, ink and paint people, the real, individuals, the real artists who created frame after frame after frame the work for these feature films that actually went into the theaters and were not done by computer animation. So you can see we change the topics very regularly. This fall we have a very large exhibition coming in from Japan on the Japanese director Akira Kurosawa with his artwork and hand-painted kimonos for his films and all sorts of things. So it's a very broad offering every year.
It is. It is a very exciting. These are very exciting offerings. And it's fascinating to be able to see and learn about the creative process that these filmmakers go through. You discussed Alfred Hitchcock, how he developed, how he worked, to get kind of inside the mind and how they create and how they saw things. It's exciting, wonderful exhibits.
That's what the Academy is really able to offer, more so than most other museums or galleries of any sort. And specifically, there really aren't too many organizations that specialize in doing exhibitions about film. But because the Academy is based on the fact of our members and the 5,500 professional filmmakers who are the members of the Academy, who are the ones who vote for the Academy Awards and who support the cultural work that the staff here does, mm-hmm. what we have is access to their creative process. And when we do the set decorator show, we actually work with the people who are in that field. Each of these topics, we actually get to know the artists themselves, people who are specializing in that particular craft, whether it's animation or they're the production designer or they're a director. And so through our exhibitions, we're able to give that first-person point of view to the visitors who come in to see the exhibits.
That's wonderful. Those are wonderful opportunities you're offering people and filmmakers themselves. In your archives, do you have any collections of papers and works from directors like Billy Wilder or any of the producers or filmmakers?
Yes,
themselves?
And actually that's one of the real treasures of the Academy is that not only do we have 8 million photographic stills and negatives and, 40,000 film posters and all of these production files and books and all these sort of things. But many, many significant people in the film industry have realized what are, the level of quality that we offer in archiving and storage and public access. And so we've received a lot of significant donations. We actually have Alfred Hitchcock's papers, and we have Gregory Peck's papers, and Katharine Hepburn's, and Fred Zinnemann's, and John Huston's, and, the list goes on and on and on of, key writers, directors, producers, and other creative people from the film business who have decided that we should have their material. We have Edith Head, for example, the most famous costume designer possibly for most people. So it's all
wonderful.
Crafts, and it's all types of materials. So it's really an exciting resource, and it's available for film students and scholars. It's available when we curate exhibitions to bring some of those items to the view of the public. So,
so these
really
are also available to the
facility.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Yes, of course.
These are also available to the public?
The public can go into research at no charge at the library, yes, absolutely.
That's wonderful. Yes. There's very exciting things going on there, and it seems to be all the time. They're wonderful, wonderful facilities.
Well, I'm glad to talk to you and get an opportunity to tell your listeners, because that's one of the big missions that we have is, the Oscar statuette and the Academy Awards loom so large in people's minds that we are always trying to get the publicity out, that we are much more than that, that the high profile of that helps us accomplish so many other things, but that we really do intend to have a facility that the public can really take advantage of. And we have actually announced that we are building a major museum in Los Angeles, so many of these efforts will come together in a new building that will have, a much higher public profile, and people will much more readily understand that the Academy is all of these things that I've been talking about.
Yep. Now, is the museum in the planning stages?
Yes, it is. We've actually found the location. We've hired the architect. We've been developing the content for it, and we're very close to actually having some plans that we'll be able to start building on.
Wow. Is there any expected date of completion? I know that
We're hoping 2012 would be a good date for us to open, so that's sort of what we're shooting for.
That's wonderful. That's exciting. I know there was on May 1st, the Academy is having a very special event, and that's the centennial tribute to Bette Davis. She is one of my all-time favorite actresses. I love her. I love her as an actress, and I love her performance and her courage. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why the Academy decided to do this tribute to Bette Davis.
Well, the Academy, every once in a while, does major tributes for significant people in the film industry. Occasionally, the people are living and with us. We had a wonderful tribute a few years ago for Olivia de Havilland, for example, at her 90th birthday. And we also occasionally do centennials for very key people in the film industry that we feel an overview of their career is really a worthwhile effort. And these evenings are hosted typically by an expert on the topic. They are a live theatrical program where we screen 15 to 20 film clips from the career of an individual, and we actually show the scene in its entirety. We don't cut film and make a quick montage kind of a program. We actually show the scenes as they were filmed. And we intersperse that with personal appearances of people who worked with the individual, maybe friends or family members, and to get a real inside scoop, as it were, as to who that person really was. And then very often we will connect it with a film series that either we host or one of our local partners. In this one, actually, we're the kickoff night for a full retrospective that's going on over 5 weekends at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art at that film department. So we'll have the sort of gala opening night, and then they'll continue running pictures throughout the month of May.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful. I know the panel is going to be hosted by Robert Osborne. He's the wonderful host of Turner Film Classics, and I understand he's kind of the official historian of the Oscars, too?
Yes, we publish a book every 5 years that is the official Academy history, which is a coffee table size book with all of the nominated categories, all of the statistics, a recap of the year, a lot of photographs, a very complete index. The 75 years of the Oscar is the most recent volume, but as you may know, this last Oscar ceremony was actually our 80th, so he is working on updating that book, and it will be the 80 years of the Oscar will be published this fall. So every 5 years, we kind of make the effort to create a new volume that keeps that history moving forward. And Bob is the official author of that.
And could you tell us about the panel members who are going to be on the tribute to Bette Davis?
Yeah, the people that we have coming to speak are a mix of people from her personal life and her professional life. We have Joan Leslie, who was a contract actress at Warner Brothers at the time that Bette Davis also was, and she appears in Hollywood Canteen, and we're actually screening that clip, and Joan Leslie will talk about that experience. And Hollywood Canteen is a very important film for Bette Davis in that it is exemplary of her war efforts. She was one of the people who actually created the Hollywood Canteen, which was essentially a nightclub for sailors and soldiers who were about to be going overseas during World War II. And it was one of the major Hollywood war efforts and something that she took great pride in having had a hand in creating. And then there was a feature film that was set there, and all of the actors who participated as hosts at the nightclub and who went there to befriend the sailors and the soldiers, they appeared as themselves in the film. So Joan Leslie will be there to kind of talk about the World War II era and also what it was like to be a contract player at at Warner Brothers during that time. And then we have some actors who she knew slightly later in her life, one who was just a very good personal friend, Jenna Rollins.
She's a wonderful actress, too.
Wonderful actress who was married to John Cassavetes and and a number of significant films on her own, but they were very close personal friends. And she was also very close to the actor James Woods, who later in her life she did appear in a television movie with him called The Disappearance of Amy, which was not a particularly significant television movie, but it was the basis of the two of them meeting and forming a very, very nice friendship. And then at this point, we're also hoping that her son, Michael Merrill, will be able to join us from his home in Boston. He was adopted by her and Gary Merrill when they were married after the making of All About Eve. And then Catherine Cermak, who was her longtime personal assistant and was with her at the time of her death and was the person who helped co-author her final book and put the notes together for Bette Davis's book that she wrote just before she passed away. So she had, and Catherine was quite young at the time and spent, you know, a decade of her life working with Bette. So she has a lot of wonderful stories to tell about sort of Bette's, you know, later years.
Wow. That sounds like a very, very interesting panel. And they'll be able to talk about her from many different aspects, and it'd be wonderful for them to share the personal friendships, too, that you get to know more about Bette Davis as a person. Because I, from what I've learned about her, she was a very special person, too, in her private life. Because we all know her that she had all these fights with Jack Warner, but she was always fighting for a better part, for a better film. And it's to our benefit because she left such a wonderful history of films that she made. I mean, it's so hard to find one that's your favorite above all because she was so great in everything, almost everything she did.
Well, she had a tremendously long career. I mean, she really worked, you know, from the 30s to the 80s. And she took on a tremendous variety of roles, and so many of them became, you know, really legendary roles and Oscar nominated so very many times.
I mean,
you know, she was nominated for Best Actress 9 times, and She received an unprecedented 5 nominations in a row every year from 1938 to 1942.
Wow.
So, you know, there are a few other great actresses who have a lot of nominations, you know, racked up. Specifically, I would say Katharine Hepburn and Meryl Streep. But, you know, there's this, Bette Davis's role in Oscar history is fairly secure from that point of view as well. And, you know, she did take on so many roles that ultimately became so identified with her, she played them so strongly that I think the public tends to get confused between the roles that she played and what Bette Davis really was like as a person. And that's one of the reasons that I think these, you know, personal reminiscences at the tribute will be so interesting and so enlightening, because she, as far as I've learned from the people who knew her, was a fiercely devoted friend, a, you know, lovely and generous person, had very strict, you know, kind of moral code and expected, you know, a high level of behavior from other people, a high level of professionalism, but that she was not, you know, the kind of draconian personality that sometimes has been painted by the press. And she took some very unfortunate hits in the media in the course of her life, especially, you know, in the context of the book that her daughter wrote about her, that, you know, the people who are close to her feel is very unfair and very inaccurate. So the evening, I think, will really address that reality.
Yes. Yeah, that was such a tragic thing, and she was so devoted to her daughter. I know it must have hurt her tremendously.
Apparently it really devastated her and was a cloud that hung over her for the rest of her life, because she never did actually communicate directly with her daughter from that point of view, but she still really loved this daughter, and I think it was really the heartbreak of her life.
What a shame. What a shame. Well, this certainly looks like it's going to be an exciting evening. I can't wait. I'm so looking forward to it. I understand that it is a sold-out event, but there might be some standby tickets available, I've been told. And I want to tell the listeners, if anyone's in the Los Angeles area and they'd like to try to get a standby ticket, they could be at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater at 6:30 on May 1st.
Actually, they should show up at 5 o'clock. We actually start distributing the standby tickets at 5. The standby procedures are on the website at oscars.org if you go and look at the Bette Davis page. What we do is we hand out standby tickets beginning at 5 p.m. People can leave and come back, because we never know exactly how many standby tickets we can sell, but we do, if there's any no-shows at all, we sell every seat, and we do that at 7:45, so people need to be back in line at 7:30, and when you receive that standby ticket, it is not a ticket for admission, but it's a numbered receipt that allows you to buy tickets in the order they were handed out based on availability. So we will sell every available seat.
Wow. Wow. And that's at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater in Beverly Hills.
That's correct. We're at 8949 Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills, and the major cross streets are Doheny and Robertson.
Great. Now, is there any... Do you have any personal favorite film of Bette Davis?
Well, you know, I like a number of her films from different periods of time in her career. I mean, I think my personal favorite, and probably I'm not at all unique in this, is All About Eve, and that's a role, obviously, that became very identified with her, and it was really kind of a triumphant role, because after years of getting really substandard parts at Warner Brothers, she managed to get out of her contract, and she went to Fox, and that's the movie that she made at Fox, and I don't think even at any point in her later career she equaled that role. It was really just sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity where she got free, you know, to take on the role that ultimately, I think, for so many people in the public, really defined her.
Yes, absolutely.
But
it was a wonderful part, too. I mean, she was really wonderful script that really she could just dig her teeth into, and she did a great job with that character.
Absolutely. But what's been very interesting for me in the course of researching this is that we've actually watched over 50 of her films in order to come up with the clips that we're going to show. We're showing 18 film clips, actually, or 19 rather, but we watched over 50 of the movies that she made in order to try to make these selections. And it's really an amazing thing to see her in her earlier roles as a young mm-hmm. actress in this sort yes. of, you know, undefined ingenue, and how strong she was and how quickly she came into her own, you know, yes. where we literally have her, you know, getting an Oscar really basically 3 years after she has her first minor part. You know, she gets on screen and you know, never stops working from that point forward. And the roles become much more significant very, very quickly. And, you know, she isn't getting the typical, you know, passive female roles. I mean, she gets some strong, really well-articulated roles. You know, 2 years into her career, she's starring in Of Human Bondage. And
yes.
that's a remarkable performance and something that I think, you know, you can't imagine somebody else, one of her peers from that yes. era, tackling that role. I mean, you know, maybe somebody like Barbara Stanwyck, but mm-hmm. it's such a unique role that,
unique role.
You know, she became kind of, you know, burned into the consciousness of the American movie-going public very, very quickly, and, you know, within just a handful of years, she is having that streak of Oscar nominations, which is, you
yes.
know, incredibly impressive.
She had so much courage in tackling roles that, such as Of Human Bondage, that were not attractive parts, and that a lot of actresses would not have played that. And she gave it 110%. Every role she played, she put so much of herself into it. She was a force. She was so exciting to watch in any of her films.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the 30s. And when she started out as an ingenue, she was not the typical Hollywood beauty, but she had a unique appearance that was very haunting, even in her early movies. She had a lot of charisma, even in the early movies that she made. You kind of couldn't take your eyes off her because you didn't know what she was going to do next. Very exciting to watch her.
Yeah, I agree absolutely, and I think it's very clear from the start. You know, she when she showed up in Hollywood initially, they really didn't know what to do with her. But
right.
as soon as she started to get a few opportunities for those, you know, bare minimum moments of screen time, as you say, not the typical glamour roles.
No.
You know, she made a mark that was so significant that very quickly she was, you know, working nonstop and making several movies every single year, you know, without any kind of break. She just became, you know, sort of the workhorse of Warner Brothers in a way.
Very much. Very hard-working woman. Well, Ellen, I can go on talking for you forever. Perhaps we can do another show at a later time.
Absolutely.
Because
we're always doing things, and we'd love to talk to your listeners at any point.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a delight, and I appreciate your time. And thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful and so exciting, and I so look forward to attending the tribute to Bette Davis and to hopefully meeting you.
Wonderful.
Thank you very
much. Look
forward
to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to all of you listening today. This is Joanna Paxinu at the Movies with Joanna, and that's a wrap.
Blog Talk Radio.